Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Rabona Podcast. Hello again, I'm Musa Kwonga and I'm joined by Ryan Hun. Very sadly, Michael De Silva, a regular member of the podcast, is indisposed for this episode. We've got a special bonus emergency podcast edition. We'll be talking about three specific issues. The first is La Liga's decision to stage games of theirs in the US from now on. The Super Cup game between Atletico Madrid and Real Madrid. A thriller, by all accounts. And finally, but not least at all, Toni Kroos' statement on Mesut Ozil's retirement from the Germany national team. So, Ryan, hello again.
Hey, mate.
Yeah.
I just got to point out, Michael's all right. He's like...
yeah, indisposed. Indisposed sounds... It sounds better. It sounds better.
He's going to hate us.
Come on, it sounds
we're
better.
We're a man down already. First bonus pod and we're a man down.
We are a person down. But we'll be joined by Colin Miller, the fantastic Spanish sports writer, football writer. He'll be joining us to discuss the La Liga decision very shortly. But Ryan, let's get into very quickly the game between Atletico and Real, because I want to talk about that. 4-2 Atletico after extra time. What does that say about the balance of power, the power shift in Spanish football?
I don't think you can draw anything too massive.
Come on, no hot takes, surely a hot take or two.
I always find Super Cups are weird games.
Right.
You know, I said this on the podcast the other day. I think something was a weird game, but, you know, it's essentially a derby, but it's being held in Tallinn. So I don't think you can draw. I think moving a derby that intense kind of, just purely from the eye test, Athletic looked really good.
Right, right.
Really good, actually. Thomas Lamar was brilliant, I thought, yesterday. I didn't watch the game live. I watched it back this morning because I would plan to watch the second half and I realised I'd missed too much of it. So watching it back this morning, Costa was brilliant.
Right.
And I've never been Costa's biggest fan. As a footballer, he's amazing, but as
an individual.
He bullied Arsenal a lot, which is probably one of the reasons for that. But his first goal was absolutely incredible.
For those who haven't seen it, he takes two of the best defenders of the world, out of the game, Ramos and Varane. He flicks the header on from a long clearance to himself, and then beats Varane with a nod forward and then thrashes the ball past Navas at the near post.
From a really, really tight finish.
Right.
Really tight angle, sorry.
And it was all premeditated, wasn't it? It was all carefully
it usually is with Costa. It was really good. I mean, I think Lopetegui's got a really difficult job. I personally, not that I am in a position to be offered the Real Madrid job, but I wouldn't have gone for that job. I don't think. If you were managing the Spanish national side, pretty decent job,
right?
And Lopetegui's he's not a very well established club manager,
right?
So I think there would have inevitably been time there for him to get that job at some point. I think stepping into the job after a guy who's won three Champions Leagues in a row.
Brutal.
There's only one way that can go.
I just think with that job though, when Real Madrid come calling, you have to go. You have to. When they come after you, it's like, if you're Gareth Bale going to Real when Ronaldo's still there. Yeah, but it's Real Madrid. And look, they get a favourite new player next year and then it's not going to be you.
Yeah, but we've had this conversation about what, Lukaku turned them down and Mbappe turned them down. So, you know, when they do come calling, you don't necessarily go without... I'm going to do this all season, by the way.
It's a fair point. I think you'll do this. I think it's look at like someone like Frank Ocean, right? Frank Ocean, obviously, sorry for the pop reference, but someone like Frank Ocean is so good. People always want to work with him. And maybe Lopetegui's choice to take this job, it reveals a slight insecurity, as in, I know I'm good, but maybe I'm not as good as the others and they're not always going to come back for me. Maybe it's that to an extent.
Yeah. I mean, I always tend to steer clear of power shift talks in derbies because derbies are such anomalies a lot of the time anyway. You know what I mean? And there was times, you know, you've seen it in... when Manchester City were far poorer than they are now, it's hard to draw conclusions.
The only reason I am is because it's clearly a result that meant a lot to the players.
Oh, it's massive.
And this is the only reason I say it, because you look at Atletico this year and they are going to be very dangerous domestically. They've strengthened, they bought Gelson Martins, I think, from Sporting Lisbon in the fire sale of all the players leaving. Obviously, Thomas Lamar's come along and they've got Kalinic from AC Milan as a backup to Costa. I mean, that is a...
Well, I think the thing that they've been so hard to break down over the under Simeone, I think the thing that they've got this season, which is a little different, is that they have genuine creative flair going forward. And numbers now. You know, Saul's a year older. And even though he's a little bit of a deeper player a lot of the time, he doesn't necessarily... go that far forward, but he's looking really good.
Well, he's devastating.
I mean, his goal was absolutely superb last night.
Two players, him and Cocker. You know, Cocker is a player who is more defensively minded. He scored as well. And actually, let's just throw this in too. Atletico scored 4 goals last night, a couple of nights ago, and there was no involvement from Griezmann.
Yeah,
Griezmann went off fairly early, so that's 4 goals without your primary striker, which is, you know, pretty impressive. Range of goal scoring.
Yeah, I saw it. I'm going to try and bring it up. There was a stat about the last time Real conceded 4. And I think they did it once under Zidane.
It never happened on him, right?
Or it never happened. Was it pre-Zidane?
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't remember. Sorry, I should have been more prepared. But also, you know, Modric didn't start the game. There was a lot of players on the pitch that had come back early from holidays.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it was a great result for Atleti. I think it was a good, I think they needed that result a lot more than Real Madrid did. I mean, apart from maybe Lopetegui, I think he could have really done with a performance.
It's definitely the first time Atletico have beaten Real Madrid in any final. I'm pretty sure that's true.
Yeah, or was it something since 91 or something, maybe? I think when they beat him in a Copa.
Copa, really? Copa.
I think.
Yeah,
back in the time. Up again. Sorry,
please correct.
Don't at me.
No, please.
Or please at me, actually.
Audience members, please correct us. And, you know, those who are, anyone who does correct us will get a like of their tweet from me. How about that as a promise? but look, La Liga, very entertaining already on the pitch. Let's do a quick segue to La Liga off the pitch.
Yeah.
And we'll be joined by Colin Miller.
Yeah, shortly.
From Sevilla to discuss the implications of the Spanish FA's decision to stage games from La Liga.
Yeah, this is really worrying, and I don't want to kind of sound too doomsday-ish, but I think this is a very, very worrying development in terms of the future of European football. And this is something that we touched a little bit on the podcast on Tuesday, where Michael, I think, brought up Arsene Wenger's quotes about how the European Super League is inevitable. And the gap that we were talking about, the gap between the top teams in a lot of European leagues and the rest. I think it's undoubtedly a measure to try and bridge the gap between the TV money of the Premier League and the TV money of La Liga. There was a thing I clocked before. So for example, I think currently the US TV deal for La Liga is done by beIN Sports, and it's $120 million a season. Whereas NBC's current Premier League deal is $1 billion for 6 years.
My goodness.
So I mean, it's not a huge amount more, but it's significant. But that is just one of many huge, huge TV. I think the current Premier League TV deal is 10 billion in total, or 10 and a half globally, including the UK and worldwide. So, and it's a problem that they've had in Spain for a long time. You know, there was the gap between the top and the bottom in terms of TV rights money. The ratio is huge. And I think there was something like...
You mentioned Almeria getting sort of about a tenth as much as, well, maybe a 15th as much as
there was, Barcelona. So I think in 2014-15, Barcelona and Real Madrid got 140 million, where Almeria came away with 18.
Right.
So if you think the commercial revenue is already huge in terms of difference, then you have $122 million a year difference between the top and bottom side. In the Premier League, I think the ratio is 1.54 to 1.
Right.
1.54 to 1, I should say. So it's still more, but obviously it's...
Almeria would be a much bigger piece of the pie if they were in the UK.
Yeah,
frankly.
And you've seen it. You've seen how rich the Championship clubs are now. Right. And even some clubs who dropped down to League One, we had that really famous thing last year, or the year that Burnley were in the Championship and they were richer than Ajax. You know, that's Ajax, who have won multiple European Cups and have provided the blueprint for much of modern football, one of the European superpowers, or historical superpowers, can't keep up financially with a club that got relegated from the Premier League and is in, you know, a smaller club. I don't want to kind of disrespect Burnley, but they're a smaller club in a kind of, you know, they're not in a major European city. You know, that's worrying.
There's a stat limit as well. Someone referred to Leicester as a small club, and it was the same year they had a bigger turnover than Roma or Marseille.
Well, this is the thing. The definition of what a big club is now is gone.
Right.
Because, you know, I was having a conversation with someone a while back and they had no idea that Aston Villa had won a European Cup, for example.
Wow, okay.
You know.
That's just a lot.
And you compare that to, I don't want to kind of bang on about Arsenal, but you compare that to Arsenal's European history, that's massive.
You know, and Nottingham Forest as well.
Yeah, back to back.
Yeah, right.
You know, and Celtic. And then you've seen Celtic struggle to get through. Well, they lost to AEK Athens. You know, in a Champions League qualifier. It's worrying. It's really worrying, and it's something that I can't see how it's going to end in any other way apart from you're just going to get the gap is going to get wider.
Right.
This European Super League is going to become inevitable at some point. Whether the Champions League stays the same or it becomes this kind of European league, and then domestic competition becomes completely secondary in all counts, cups, leagues, what have you. But the one thing we kind of mentioned we'll touch on with Colin, but how they're going to structure this as well.
Right.
Is it going to be an extra game? Or is it just going to be one game in the fixture that a team will have to play? So maybe a team will lose a home game, or a team will lose an away game.
Hmm. Or like a marquee weekend where they have like a kind of, you know, super soccer Saturday or Sunday, you know,
yeah.
Kind of, you know, who knows.
And but the thing is, they quote a lot of the time the you know, US sports, but the NBA and the NFL are completely different beasts. Hmm. You know, the NBA, they do games in London now, and they've done games in Mexico, regular season games. But that's an 82-game season, where some teams will play each other four times a season.
The NFL, they're very clever because they often have games between teams that aren't really contenders, if you've noticed that. Mm. So I went to see, I think it was the Tampa Bay Buccaneers played against the Chicago Bears. Jay Cutler, my goodness, he stank out the joint at Wembley. I went to that game a few years back. Quite a few listeners might have.
But again, with the NFL, sorry to cut in, but they don't play each other twice a season, so they have no home game and away game.
Okay,
it's drawn.
That's advantage, right.
So, you know, when you only have two games a season against the club, and one is home and one is away, you remove one of those, and it is the format of league football in Europe. That is huge.
As a decisive factor in the league. No, you're right. You're right. And in a tight league, we could see this game, or these games, whichever they are, being decisive in a title race. And then we would have a clear case of the tail wagging the dog.
And you see the conspiracies that fly up in Spain, especially between Barcelona and Real Madrid now, if they want to move a Clásico there, and it's the Clásico that would have been at the Bernabeu,
right?
you know, the amount of like conspiracies that, like basically, for those who don't know, and I assume you probably all do, is Real Madrid fans and players assume that all the refs are biased towards Barcelona and vice versa.
Right, absolutely.
So if the league makes a decision to move the Barcelona Clásico, then you just, I just don't see, I cannot it's see how this works.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe this would be a good time to
bring in Colin.
Bring in Colin.
The man on the spot. Yeah, the man with the knowledge of Spanish football on and off the pitch. So yeah, let's get Colin. And now here to join us to discuss La Liga's decision to play one game per season in the US from now on is the wonderful Colin Miller, joining us from Sevilla, I believe.
Yes, at the minute I am, Sevilla, yes. So listen, it's lovely to be on, and thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So Colin, what are you up to at the moment, if I can give you a quick recap of your current activities?
Well, at the moment, I'm sort of floating in between London and Sevilla. Sevilla's sort of been my home for the past 18 months, and I've been in London a little bit for work purposes as well. And I largely report on Spanish football, and
right.
At the moment, I'm actually writing a book about football in Seville in particular. So between the sort of rivalry between Sevilla and Real Betis. And all that goes with that. So I've been keeping very busy, as you can imagine. But
can we get sorry, Colin? Can we get an advanced preview of that when that's done? Because that sounds amazing.
Yeah. Wow.
Oh yeah. Well, absolutely. I'm willing to promote by any.
What a pro he is! He came straight in. He was always marketing himself.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite football rivalries.
Yeah, so. It's fantastic, and the food might be amazing too in the region.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing city. Whenever you're here, you feel incredibly privileged, and I just think it's the one to report it in general as well. You know, it almost sums up everything that's great about Spanish football, in my opinion. And I just thought I'd like to document it and to go through the history and just explain why it is the way it is. So yeah, that's what I'm doing mainly, and yeah, so hopefully that all comes together.
Well, fantastic. Well, listen, we just had a great sort of exposition of why Spanish football is so great because of the region it's in, you know, the regionalism of it. But we've now got this kind of globalism in the game. We've got La Liga going to the US. I mean, how do you feel about that? Is that going to be bad for the culture of Spanish football?
Well, I mean, in my opinion, it's something that has actually... When I saw the news, I was pretty shocked by it, to be honest. I mean, I think everybody was whenever you see that there's this elite football league who's taken the decision to move some of its league games to not just another country, but another continent. And there's absolutely... There wasn't any dressing up of it, to be fair. You know, the statements from the league and from those involved are clear. Like, this is a money-driven opportunity. It's to increase sponsorship and marketing, and it's to drive more people towards these clubs as a brand rather than as a club or as an institution. So what has happened is La Liga signed a 15-year deal with a company called Relevant Sports, which is headed by Stephen Ross, who, right. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but he's the billionaire owner of the NFL team, the Miami Dolphins.
Right.
And he's also been the guy that's driven the International Champions Cup, the friendly tournament mainly in the US, between the sort of top European continental clubs in pre-season, and he's the guy behind this. And you know it's something that's been coming in a way in
yes. sense
with the International Champions Cup. I mean, we saw the first El Clasico played there last year, and that was the first played outside Spain in, I think it was 26 years since 1991. And these other little bits and pieces, and another hugely influential figure behind this is the president of La Liga. He's called Javier Tebas, and he's a very outspoken figure who doesn't, let's say, he doesn't shy away from controversy or from upsetting fans. He's called this a groundbreaking agreement, which I suppose it is. I mean, you know, it's certainly a landmark deal. Tebas, he's a guy who he views himself as an innovator. You know, he's a bit of a trendsetter. And to be fair to him, you can see where he's coming from. He's trying to build up this market for the Spanish League, the Trump
right.
Premier League, the Trump Serie A, which have traditionally been the two leagues which have attracted the largest number of fans from abroad. But he's kind of reshaped La Liga over the past number of years. He's been in charge. He's the guy that's behind the sort of the TV schedules as well. There's been a lot of sort of fan protests regarding the Friday night, Monday night kickoff times. And just the fact that he's probably familiar with it, in a sort of typical La Liga weekend, there's very rarely are there any games that overlap of each other, all spread out over separate times.
Yes, for TV but purposes.
So it's to ensure that as many games are televised as possible, and they're broadcast to as many countries as possible, and that's the reason behind why in recent years as well, the Saturday, well, in the UK, the Saturday 3 p.m. times, obviously it's 4 o'clock in Spain, those games are put on at those times, and in the past few seasons, it's been Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, or Barcelona have been prioritised for those time slots. Now, the reason for that is they're trying to appeal to the Asian market, in particular, particularly the Chinese market, which I think there's actually more La Liga viewers than Premier League viewers, as opposed to sort of Korea and Japan and the other nations around that area. So he's tried to nail down the Chinese market and to try and spread out a little bit from there. And obviously a lot of these late night kickoffs that are in Spain. And you have to remember as well, these late night kickoffs in Spain, a lot of them go past midnight.
This all makes sense on a kind of financial level. It all makes perfect sense. Yes, but then you think of the human element, you know, and you sent a tweet out, which I think is part of this wider conversation. You mentioned the Sevilla Barcelona Spanish Super Cup game taking place in Tangier in a stadium that really wasn't fit for purpose, and the fans were very angry. And, you know, the thing is, the Spanish FA got the viewing figures it presumably wanted out of that, which is why they did it where they did it. You know, so they were happy on a kind of like macro level, but the fans, you know, the fan experience, I hate to see, you know, sound like it's a cliche here, but that's going to go missing, isn't it, to some extent, if we keep going down this road, if we just keep pursuing the dollar or the euro or whatever it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just a total erosion of fans' rights. And I mean, I just sort of explained about the kickoff times there. I mean, they have upset fans. There's been protests, but they don't care. And the reason they don't care is that they know the fans ultimately will want to watch their club, especially if they can get to the stadium, they will, but they'll watch it on TV if they can't. They know that they are people who they can rely upon no matter what. And that is why, that's why they aren't listened to, and in the sense that it's logical that they should be listened to. And there is another element that should probably be explained, in that in Spain, the fan culture isn't quite the same as it would be in, let's say, the UK or in the Bundesliga in Germany, whereby, you know, you always have, or you usually have, packed out stadiums, you have fans week in, week out. But there's a myriad of reasons behind why it's not the same in Spain. Partly it's because of geography and the mass distances between clubs is simply not possible. There's also very limited away ticket allocations for clubs. Right. The prices are reasonably high, the kickoff times, everything else. There's also a culture of pennies and, you know, watching it with your supporters club rather than going to an away game. So there's all this behind it. So they have seen fans as this sort of expendable kind of, like, they're going to be here no matter what. They've taken them completely for granted. Now, it's the same in other leagues too, but this is, I mean, as you said, it's another step. And you referenced the Spanish Super Cup in Tangier, a stadium that clearly had absolutely no right to be hosting such a match. And Sevilla even released a statement that was saying, like, the Spanish FA said that they've spoken with the clubs and they confirmed this. Well, they didn't speak to us. And as a result, the main fan groups of Sevilla boycotted the game. Maybe a small day ultra group and the main Peña Federation just said, look, we're not involved with this, because this is a decision which is disrespectful to us, it's disrespectful to the club and everything else that goes with it. And I mean, there was videos emerged afterwards which showed the insufficient facilities at the stadium in terms of people queuing up and having to climb over gates to get into the. I mean, it was almost like something from the 70s or 80s.
Right.
You know, it's these images which just seems so out of place, not keeping in the modern world. But this, so nobody really understood the decision to play that match in Morocco. But I mean, as we've seen, it's just the slow, casual erosion of the sort of traditional venues, the traditional way of doing things. I think this is a step too far. I think fans think that as well. But I mean, as we've sort of discussed, I mean, how much do they matter?
Right. Yeah. And I think that's actually is the kind of. This is maybe a touchstone, you know, the Tangier game and the La Liga decision to go and play in the US. It's all of a piece, and I think it's part of a conversation that's just set to run, not only this season, but for maybe a few seasons to come.
Yeah, Colin, can I just cut in quick? Sorry. So with the decision to move the some La Liga games to the US, I mean, I tried to look, but there hasn't been any sign of how many games that will be, whether it will be one, whether it will be multiple. When I mean, the only thing they seem to say is that they're looking to start that this season. Do you have any idea? Yeah, do you have any idea about what they're looking to do there?
I mean, the statement does come across as deliberately vague. But they do say that they want to ideally to start this season, you know, which is incredible. Really, they release a statement on the eve of the season kicking off to be like, well, actually, this year is going to be, we're going to try and get games not in Spain, even whenever the calendar's been released. It is, in that sense, it's absolutely insane. And I think a few media sources have tried to find out the answers to this. They've contacted the league, and they've essentially had a no comment. And an interesting element of this is you can kind of draw a parallel to the Premier League plans of a decade ago now, of Richard Scudamore, whenever he tried to be like, you know, we've got this big idea, the 39th match that we're going to play abroad. And eventually, I think that was vetoed by Sepp Blatter's FIFA, ironically enough, at the time, being like, this isn't going to happen, it's off the table. And his response to it was, okay, but this will happen when the conditions are right. And so we're fast forward 10 years on to now, and the Spanish Federation have obviously considered that, you know, the conditions are now right. The one little thing I would put up against this is that FIFA haven't actually released a statement about this. There has been nothing to indicate that they have been directly consulted or have given any sort of approval. Now, that's not to say that they won't, because that ladder is no longer involved. It's obviously a different regime there. And let's face it, FIFA aren't exactly the sort of vanguard of fan rights a lot of the time. Mm. And I wouldn't be really optimistic that they will put up a fight to block it. But it just seems so odd. I mean, the sense I get is that they want to maybe, if they would be optimistic to get one game this season in the US, and that would sort of provide them with the kind of guinea pig, if you like, to go on in future seasons and maybe have two or three games. And all the reports point that it'll be on the grid in Barcelona, will be the two clubs involved for obvious reasons. I'm sure it's being the most marketable entities as they see it. But I think eventually they're going to try and spread as much as possible. And the other thing is, it's been a very interesting statement released by the Spanish Footballers Association, and it essentially reads, as per usual, La Liga has dispensed with the opinions of the players and has taken actions that only benefit them, regardless of the health risks to the players, and even less the feelings of the following masses of the clubs who are being forced to compete in North America once a season. And it ends by saying, footballers are not currency that can be used in business to only benefit third parties. And I think that statement speaks volumes of how footballers feel, how fans feel, of how everybody feels, other than the people who have taken this decision. But certainly it's deliberately vague to the point where it can't be directly questioned in terms of specifics. But I think it's fairly clear what we're going down here.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the first thing that I thought when I read the statement was, there's no way the clubs have voted on this yet, or there's no way the clubs have been consulted, because it was so vague, and you're trying to figure out what games they will use. Like, for example, me and Musa are both big NBA fans. And, you know, when you're dealing with something like the NBA, which isn't just a round robin home and away, you play each other twice a season. You know, they've started experimenting with games abroad. They had a couple in London, they have one in Mexico, but they're usually between people in the same conference or even division, which means that they play each other four times a season. So the importance of that one specific game within an 82 game season is minimal, you know. Whereas with something like Premier League or La Liga, when you only play teams twice, or you only play each other twice, home and away,
can we be brutal? Let's be brutally honest. They're going to want the Clásico because Ronaldo's gone now, right? So to get that thing sold out, to get that match sold out, they're going to say, look, bring me Messi. I can imagine them being like, bring me Messi. Barcelona are the biggest ticket in town now that Ronaldo's gone. That kind of dichotomy is gone to an extent.
But one of the best things about the Clásico, as someone who doesn't live in Barcelona or Madrid, is seeing a Clásico at the Nou Camp or at the Bernabeu.
Right, I agree.
And if you take one of those elements out of it, the stadium, it's just not the same.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. It's interesting about the NBA comparison there, because Tabas, the league's president, he has cited directly the NBA and the NFL, obviously playing games outside of their own environments, as he calls them. So he's like, well, why can we not do that? Why can the Spanish league not do that? And it's important because basketball is such a massive sport here in Spain. Like, it's probably a second sport to football. Yeah. And I think a lot of the time, people people try to sort of take elements of each sport, they apply it to the other in terms of like, how can we develop, how can we improve, and you know. But this is, as we've spoken about, this is especially and specifically about a brand. It's not about a sport, but it doesn't fit into the sporting sense or objective or the sporting nature of a league. When it's a round robin 38 game season, there's going to be clubs will directly lose out, even if it's just one match. Those two clubs involved and their fans, their players, everybody involved is going to lose out. So the league will almost by definition be unequal and unfair. And I cannot comprehend how they thought that this was going to work and how it will work. It'll be fascinating to see what they actually do with it. But on the other, you're sort of like, well, it's only going to be losers in this process, you know?
Yeah. Sorry, one more question before I forget. Do you think this is, I mean, it's been well publicised, the difference between the TV money in La Liga and the Premier League and the Premier League and everywhere else. The distribution of the TV money in the Premier League has, you know, the ratio is a lot closer than it has been in La Liga historically. Although I do believe they signed a new deal last season or this year, if that's correct. So the gap isn't so wide. Is that right?
Well, yeah, theoretically, yes. The new deal, the devil's in the detail a little bit. It's quite a complicated mechanism. But yes, I think it's essentially the sort of lower classes, as it were, of Spanish top flight will be given a little bit more. But essentially what happens is the new deal will be signed significantly more in total, and top clubs will still be far and away out from the rest. It's going to be an incredibly imbalanced league. But you know, if you look at this decision of where football is going in general, I just think this is so significant. And I mentioned as well a potential European Super League, whereby the sort of cup format of the Champions League will essentially be merged into a league for super clubs. I don't see how that's not going to happen at some point. Certainly within the next 10 or 15 years, it just seems increasingly inevitable with all the noises that are coming from football authorities and how they're just becoming ever closer to commercial companies and the money-making facilities. It's hugely worrying on one hand to see just how quickly things like these ideas and concepts can take off, and just the sense this could happen as soon as this season, which is essentially underway already. It's certainly something that creeps up very quickly.
Yeah, and we were actually talking about this on the podcast the last podcast we did on Tuesday, which is why we decided to actually do this one today, because it seems a little bit spooky that it happened. Yeah. It was the first real, it feels to me like this is the first real significant step in the direction of a Super League. There's always been, I have this theory that I've been banging on about for a bit, where, you know, as soon as the Cup Winners' Cup got taken away and it was just became the Europa League and the Champions League, that this was the way it was going to go. And you're seeing how the split in domestic leagues between the top one or two or dominant forces in Spain and France and Italy compared to the rest of the things. But now this seems, I mean, the first thing I did when I saw that was just, it was like, uh-oh.
Can I say this as well? I think that Sepp Blatter, weirdly enough, is going to emerge as a moderating force in global football for all of Blatter's problems and all the issues with him, which are well documented and absolutely very real. If you look at Blatter, Blatter's a guy that didn't want the World Cup to go to Qatar. And Blatter's a guy that didn't want the 39th game. So this is someone who actually understood fundamentally, even for Blatter, like, this is going too far. This is eroding the fan experience. If that makes sense.
Yes.
Because Infantino...
No, I totally agree, yes.
Infantino, yeah. He's up for anything. He's up for anything. This guy is, you know.
So do you have, Colin, do you have any ideas of what games they will want? Do you think they're going to force for stuff like the Clásico, or do you think they're going to maybe run like, like a one weekend of the season there eventually or something like that? Because it does, I mean, you know... If this plan happens, it's, you know, I doubt you're going to see, like, you know, Girona Alaves or something like that in New York or something, right?
Yeah, I think El Clasico will be the ultimate goal for them to move that abroad. But I think they might have some semblance of self awareness to do this as a kind of baby steps process at first. I imagine that the easiest logistical games they could shift over would be, say, a Real Madrid or Barcelona home game against, let's say, a team who are in the mid to lower half of the league,
right,
which might not have the highest demand among fans, and which they can maybe sell as a, look, you know, we're going to do this. It's going to drive up whatever. well, actually, you know, I don't know how they're going to sell it, but they're going to have to. But it'll be the easiest to do. This game's low demand. That might be a sort of a given, as it were, for the big club to win in any case. It's like, well, the visiting club might look at it. It's like, oh, well, what do we have to lose? You know, this, you know, it could actually have benefits for us. I don't know. I would imagine that's the easiest logistically for the league to pull off. But again, I actually think that by saying we're looking to do it this season, I'm not sure how realistic that is. I think they might be saying that from the off. And then when it turns out that isn't going to happen, they could be like, well, look, that's what we said, and we have kind of compromised on this.
It's an opening gambit, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's like all these things. I mean, you look at the kind of International Champions Cup and the 39th game suggestion. I think these are all kind of like testing the water, really, aren't they?
Yes.
And a process of attrition. Colin, so listen, I've kept you for plenty of time actually already. Thank you so much for that contribution, because, I mean, it's been an education for me primarily, but I'm sure for the listeners too. But before you leave us, can you give us an idea of where we can find you? Because you've basically given us, I mean, it's an incredible sort of like sweeping dissertation on the current issues of Spanish football. So where can we find more of your work?
Well, I'm most active, as it were, on my personal Twitter account.
Oh, right.
And the handle is @Miller_Colin. So it's @MILLAR_Colin.
Fantastic.
And I talk about a whole range of issues in there, but I try to focus it in on football, and obviously particularly Spanish football. And I can imagine that there'll be quite a lot to come over the coming season with the myriad of controversy both on and off the field. It could be quite a season.
Well, it'd be lovely to have you back, actually, Colin, because I think you'll be a big hit with the listeners in this podcast. But also just great to hear your sort of take. I mean, we obviously hadn't spoken before today, but for me, it's been an education, but also a great pleasure. It's been an honour to have you on. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, that's very lovely, Brad Smith. It's lovely to be on. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Colin.
And last but not least, Tony Kroos has come out with a statement on Mesut Ozil's retirement from international football, from the German national team. And it's fair to say the comments are fairly fairly controversial, fairly spirited, fairly frank, as we've come to expect from Kroos on and off the pitch. And Ryan, I mean, let's just get straight into it. So Kroos has come out and basically said that Ozil is a player who's got, you know, distinguished history at this level, had a fine career, but his retirement was not entirely befitting of the player that he was. I mean, what the precise words have you got in there? You can bring
I've got some of his quote here. Basically, Mesut is a deserved international, and as a player, he deserved a better departure. And this is Kroos' quotes in Bild, which is a tabloid paper in Germany. But the way he resigned was not in order, he says. And what else did he say? The parts in his statement that are rightly addressed are unfortunately overshadowed by the significantly higher amount of nonsense. I think he knows very well that racism within the national team and the DFB does not exist. That's the key line for me, that
right,
last one.
Interesting.
Because I think a lot of the rest of the statement can be down to, you know, we have this conversation a bit, and we brought in basketball quite a lot in this show already, but European footballers aren't used to talking about issues like this so much,
right,
with a microphone in front of them. Mm. Whereas if, you know, the NBA, it's a very kind of like progressive league, coaches, players often talk about issues like racism, social injustice, yada, yada, yada. So part of it can be down to maybe him not articulating it in the right way. But, you know,
I think we're slightly generous to him there.
We are. I mean, yeah. I'm a straight white guy, and I am not feeling very, I wouldn't feel very confident if three straight white guys from
like
within
Manuel
the football
Neuer,
squad,
Thomas Müller,
Müller, Kroos,
yeah,
came out and said, no, this is actually fine.
Mm.
Because I think for a lot of straight white people, massively, I'm being very general here. So, you know, I mean, speaking from my own personal experience, I think we've had conversations about this over coffee and stuff before, where I think that a lot of what happens gets missed.
Mm.
And you can try to understand as much as possible, but you can never fully understand what it is like for minorities in situations like that, because you aren't exposed to those kind of like microaggressions on a daily basis. you know, Toni Kroos.
Oh, so when we say microaggressions, I suppose we mean sort of like provocations or acts of disdain.
Yeah.
But not just that, but I think actually we can talk about straightforward aggressions. Like, you know, Mesut Ozil had to deal with being called a goat effer by a leading German politician.
Yeah.
You know,
which is something that Kroos, you know, Kroos, Neuer, I mean, Neuer's a little bit different because of just where he was born and brought up. But, you know, Kroos and Müller, they're Bayern boys.
Mm.
They're white German Bayern boys.
Mm.
You know, when they lose, they're still white German Bayern boys.
So the kind of, I suppose what you're saying is the backlash that they would get is disproportionate. Well, the backlash...
Their heritage is never going to be brought into it. You know what I mean? And this is the thing, like, this is a common thread that has gone through football that has been raised a lot recently. Lukaku, prime example. You know, when I win, I'm Belgian. When we lose or I don't score, I'm the Belgian from... I'm the Congolese Belgian or the Belgian from Congolese descent. Same with the thing in Ozil's statement, when I win, we're German, when I lose, we're Turkish.
I want to get into the Kroos thing. So I think there's some aspects where I agree with him and others where I depart from him quite significantly. So Kroos talks about Ozil making a statement where most of it's nonsense. So I think if you say that, you've got to spell out the parts that you think are right and that aren't right. He makes a comment elsewhere, Kroos, about the fact that Ozil could have dealt with this a lot sooner, referring to the photo he took with President Erdogan just before the tournament and before the Turkish elections. He could have dealt with this photo situation much earlier and he didn't. And I think he's referring there to his frustration and that of other players in the squad, it seems, that Ozil didn't come out, didn't attend the press day when the controversy broke. So basically had a lot of like Ozil's teammates having to answer for him. That must have created some resentment because they're preparing for a big tournament. They're defending the World Cup, which is, as we know, is historically very difficult for teams to do. Most teams that win the World Cup don't make it out of the group stages after winning the following tournament. There was a lot of frustration from Kroos there about Ozil's management of the situation.
I think he's fair there.
I think
it's key to, we didn't really, I mean, this story is kind of blown over. We wouldn't be talking about this if we hadn't read this today because it happened while we weren't doing podcasts. But I think that it's very key to stress here that the two things are separate, in my opinion.
Right.
I think you can be critical of Ozil for posing and posting the picture. You can be critical of Ozil for not addressing that sooner, but that doesn't mean that the treatment and the language and the reaction to him during and post World Cup is in any way justifiable.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And unfortunately, we spoke with Uli Hesse about this during the World Cup, and just after Germany got knocked out, before Ozil announced, well, I mean, he hasn't technically retired, he's just announced that he stepped away. And he said that he wouldn't be surprised if Gundogan and Ozil didn't play for Germany again.
Right.
And at the time I thought, oh, wow, that's heavy. And but he was totally right. And I think that's because, unfortunately, Germany is in a very different place politically now than it was when they won the World Cup.
Right.
You know, when they won the World Cup, it was pre the big crisis in Syria with, well, I'm not sure if it was pre the crisis, but it was definitely pre
the arrival of refugees and asylum seekers.
And that act has massively shifted a lot of the discourse in Germany. And
Turkey has also become much more authoritarian in the last, much more visibly authoritarian.
The political landscape across Europe has completely changed.
Right.
You know, and I think it gave people a scapegoat to vent a lot of issues through, or funnel a lot of issues outside of football through. From a football point of view, and from an issue in terms of how young German footballers or German sports people or just Germans identify going forward, I think the repercussions of this are going to be huge. If you are, for example, a 15-year-old German footballer, who is going to play professional, and you have parents or grandparents not from Germany, so you're first or second generation, if a guy who was instrumental in winning Germany a World Cup played for Real Madrid,
one of the greatest playmakers in German history,
and was 5-time German player of the Football of the Year in the last 6 years, if he isn't German enough.
Right. No. And I think that's what Kroos was sort of struggling to rushing to defend, the sense that look how diverse our team is. Look at someone like Sami Khedira. And it's funny because Sami Khedira, you know, someone of, I think, Tunisian heritage, yeah. came out at the time of the controversy when it was at its height. Well, I say its height, its previous height. It's gone higher again now, I think. Khedira came out and said, look, Gundogan and Ozil know what they were doing when they posed with Erdogan, and they know how to sort it, how to solve it. And they might hold out, you know, someone like Cruz might hold out someone like Khedira and say, look, this is a guy who's integrated, who gets it.
Sorry to just the button there. In case you move on to another point, but on that note, there was, I think again, is this really hard to come at? I think sometimes from a straight white male perspective, because I'm not Turkish, my family's not Turkish, my family don't live in Turkey.
Right.
So if a figure like that says, hey, you're from Turkish heritage, pose with a picture for me, as in Erdogan. Rafa Honigstein made a really good point about this in an article he wrote where you saw it with Enes Kanter, who, again, another NBA reference. Mm. He's an NBA player, Turkish, very outspoken against Erdogan and the regime in Turkey. Had to flee whilst he was on holiday in Asia. And I think he was going through Romania, had his passport cancelled by Turkey, you know, because of it.
Because of his statement against Erdogan.
Yeah. So if you have... it was very, very, it was very ill-advised. Do you know what I mean? And it's not.
I suppose you're saying the repercussions of having family in Turkey.
It's maybe not as easy to say no as it may be for you and I. Do you know what I mean?
I just think I still think I get that. I just think that
that's giving Ozil the benefit of the doubt.
Look, I think I love Ozil as a player. We you know, as he's done tremendous things. I just think that his position became untenable from the moment he handled it badly. I think the first 72 hours after the story broke, if Ozil had come out then and said, you know, had made some kinds of comments about it, then I think it would have been easier for him. But then I think subsequently, if you look at someone like Oliver Bierhoff, who actually Ozil says was quite supportive during the tournament, afterwards throws him under the bus and comes out with quotes that basically are kind of almost like German nationalist talking points. You know, Bierhoff comes out and says, Ozil had a very bad World Cup and implies that's because he wasn't committed to the team, to his country. Whereas, you know, the stat about Ozil creating, you know, more chances per 90 minutes than anyone else in the tournament. Mm-hmm. And Ozil actually against South Korea didn't have the worst game of the attackers, was actually one of the better attackers in that game.
Germany. I mean, I have like, I think this is again, I think the DFB handled it so badly.
I think so, yeah.
So badly that I think that escalated the issue. And actually, I think that they could have worked a lot closer. And I'm not going to say that they could have, because I don't know how closely they worked with Ozil, but from an outsider's perspective who has no insight into the workings of the DFB or how it was handled, it seemed as though everyone could have been on the same page.
I almost feel like Ozil was naive about the extent to which
it was. Totally. And this is again what we've said a million times. It is very, I'm not for one second defending Ozil in the initial action, but I'm defending him in the response, which I see as two separate things.
For Cruz to come out and say, you know, because no one ever said there was racism in the German national team. That was interesting. That was never an allegation that was made. Ozil never at any point said that other players in the team had any kind of...
No, it was specifically in the DFB.
It was funny how Cruz would mention that. I thought that was a bit weird. But the DFB, you know, and Grindel in particular, the president, you know, that's where he had the issue. And I feel like...
The issues were specifically with Grindel specifically with the fan that attacked him after the game and called him Turkish, whatever, this, that, and the other. And the language used by the politician when the squad was announced. I think it was when the provisional 25-man squad was made, it was a leading German politician said 23 Germans and two go effers, which was Gundogan and Ozil.
Yeah, which is that kind of insult for like sort of Turkish working class. So that's the kind of, you know, the assumption.
Yeah, and then he suggested that he should go back to a certain part of Turkey, which is well known for having immigrants. So it's, and you can't justify
that. People have to understand as well, because, you know, we're broadcasting from Germany, from undisclosed location in Berlin, Rabona Tower, as I call it. You know, people have to understand the intensity of the political debate right now is such that the Minister of the Interior, Horst Seehofer, recently said, I'm not sure what Seehofer said, there is no place for Islam in Germany. I mean, that's an extraordinary... I don't think it was Seehofer. It wasn't Seehofer, but a leading German politician said that there was no place for Islam in Germany. I mean, that's the level of the discourse. Imagine the Home Secretary in the UK saying that, Which actually, I mean, we've got Boris Johnson now, so we're kind of going that direction at the moment.
Well, I just think this is maybe something we should say for a more specific podcast, but right. Like, I think that the quality, if you like, or the level of discourse, you've seen it with Sterling.
Right.
Pogba, even, you mm-hmm. know, and you've seen it with a lot of the French national side in bits and bobs. There are pockets of people and politicians around Europe who don't like integration. And and I think that it's very easy to put that aside for those people when you're winning or when your Belgium striker of Congolese descent is banging in 25 goals a season.
Right, right.
But, you know, can you imagine if, for example, Giroud was of... I don't know, Senegalese descent or something in the World Cup and didn't score.
Yeah.
You know, before they won the trophy.
Mm. I think there's a sensitivity issue with the handling of it. And I think at this point in Germany, in its sort of political trajectory, there needs to be greater sensitivity. You're going to come out on the record and make a statement like Cruyff made. You've got to basically like be a bit more empirical and lay out where you feel the issues are and be more nuanced about it. But listen, on a brighter note, on a more rousing note to end the podcast, Zinedine Zidane.
Next United manager.
His name is being floated in connection with Manchester United. This is not really about...
We're delving into speculation. We are a gossip podcast.
But look, we are a gossip podcast. Come on, like, it's a football podcast. To an extent. We can look, we evolve like Pokemon. We're many things. We contain multitudes. This isn't about United per se. It's about Zidane. And the question of really, like, how good a coach is... He's an enigma. How good a coach is Zidane, really?
Yeah, well, there was that amazing thing that was floated around when they won the third European Cup. And it was, I can't remember who wrote it now. So I apologize for not giving them credit. But it was something like, I'm going to have to explain to my grandkids that Real Madrid won the European Cup 3 years in a row whilst not actually that good. And Zidane won 3 Champions Leagues in a row whilst actually maybe not being that good a coach. Which is a bizarre thing to say out loud,
right?
But
it's the Didier Deschamps thing. Like, how good is Deschamps? Like, people still won't know. But I think the key is this. The answer is this. As a motivator of men, of footballers, Zidane and Deschamps are obviously superb at that. Because if you look at that World Cup and the youth of the players in Deschamps' squad, Deschamps found a structure that was secure enough for them to express themselves. If someone like Diego Simeone had coached the French squad, right, would have said, amazing job.
The thing about Zidane is the honest answer is we just don't know. Because I think that the skill set you need to manage that Real Madrid dressing room it's very different to a lot of other clubs in Europe. You've seen with Rafa Benitez, unique. Prime example. Rafa Benitez, we were bigging him up on the podcast the other day, done an incredible job everywhere he's gone. The worst period of his career was probably Real Madrid.
Right.
It's a very different skill set. And I think that the thing with there is so much quality in that Real Madrid dressing room that it's almost that you need someone. Zidane is perfect because he is, half of that team would have idolized him when they were growing up.
Right.
You know.
And he's very hands off, isn't he?
And he's been in that position, and he can still meg people in training.
Right, that's a huge thing. That's a huge
and
factor.
That brings to people of that elite level. That brings them down a little bit.
Yeah,
it's really massively important. Humbling. Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. You know, you're seeing that maybe with Lopetegui.
Mm.
Like, can his skill set translate to that dressing room? You saw it with Emery at PSG. Undoubtedly a very, very good manager. Done an incredible job at Valencia, incredible job at Sevilla. Did all right at PSG, to be fair.
All right, yeah, he did all right.
But it's an anomaly.
The half-time team talk that Zidane gives when Real play Juventus in the Champions League final. And he's just basically saying pretty standard stuff. He's like, Marcelo, maybe advance a bit more. You do this, do that. We're going to win the second half. We're 1-1. It's nothing profound, but the point is, it's Zidane saying it, and this is a man who's won Champions Leagues, who's won, you know, the World Cup, and you look at him, you're like, well, if he says it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Then you go off and do it. And I think that's the thing. I think what Zidane needs, I think he's a great head coach, but he also needs a very tactical number two and an incredible sporting director. And if he gets all of that, then he's wonderful.
In a very similar position to where we were with Guardiola, where you just don't know. I mean, there was a lot of people when Guardiola left Barca who still were like,
I was different because I could see what you'd done.
I mean, you could see, like, I'm saying that a lot of people were like, would use the, oh, he had Messi, or he had all this, 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 you know, and anyone could win with that kind of team. And that's a similar thing that you could maybe point out with that Madrid squad, even though they didn't win the league, but, you know, it's still, it's not a bad squad.
Right.
I think the thing with Guardiola was that he made such gigantic stylistic shifts.
Yes.
And you could see football being pushed in a new direction that it hadn't been pushed before.
Real have no legacy in a sense of whereas, they want no tactical legacy.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas Zidane hasn't redefined or re-engineered like Real Madrid's football structure in terms of their style and identity in the last 3 years. Because to be honest, their football in style and identity over years and years and years, certainly as long as I can remember watching Real Madrid, has just been to sign the biggest players in the world.
And then to win. Yeah,
exactly. That's
it. Yeah.
Whereas, and then, you know, Guardiola, you go to Bayern and then to City, and you've seen how much he has changed things. Yeah. And yeah, he spent a lot of money, but unfortunately, I think that the players that you need to fully understand what he's trying to tell you and to implement that, I think they cost money now.
No, that's absolutely right. And
so,
I think.
I would actually personally love, because I love Zidane, I would love him to go to Man United and win the league. Do you know what I mean? And actually, I would love him to be a really good manager.
But you can't necessarily see.
We just don't know that.
We don't know, yeah.
But I think, actually, maybe, think about it, what clubs in the world would you compare to Real Madrid? United are probably the closest comparison.
I would say if he went to a club like that, and not to get too much into United because they're my team, and I don't want to sort of make that into kind of
you don't have to caveat that. You're not a biased. You know,
well, I just think I don't want to, like, you know, get too past.
He's not here, so I can talk about him. But Michael's the most biased. You saw him the other day when he jumped to Spurs' defense.
Michael's going
to
kill us. I just think with the thought of Zidane at United, I think he's one manager for whom the owners will be persuaded to really open the coffers. They'd be like, we've got a marquee manager, let's spend significant amounts of money. And we'll say to him, look, long-term development, or buy players that are young and just bring the best out of them. And I do think if someone like him went there with the right kind of recruitment behind him, it would be a major coup, because there'd be players who would crawl on hands and knees to play for Zidane.
Yeah, there, you know, sure. And that dressing room would, I mean, we're kind of like assuming that Mourinho is already gone here. But
it's a possibility.
This is a hypothetical, you know, to clarify. Yeah. But I think that, I don't want to slag Mourinho, but I just think that you take him out of that dugout and you put Zidane in there, and the whole atmosphere in the dressing room just shifts completely, 100%. Pogba has just won the World Cup for France, you know, and he's playing under a guy who won the World Cup for France last time.
And Zidane,
and the only time before
Zidane comes in and says, look, you're going to win the Ballon d'Or. You're like the best, whatever.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, from a neutral, it would be mega fun seeing Zidane in the Premier League.
It'd be intriguing, wouldn't it?
And really fun at Man United as well, because it's only going to go two ways, I think.
It'd be nice to have a better looking manager than Guardiola in the dugout as well. I think that's important too. I think Zidane was the first male model for L'Oreal. I think that's the first.
Really?
Yeah. He's a handsome man. I think it's about, Guardiola's had it a bit too much his own way in terms of like the good looking ones. He's kind of out by himself at the moment, really.
What's your beef with Sam Allardyce?
So on that rousing note, before this becomes the Big Sam cast,
we're going to get so much hate mail.
We will get so much hate mail. Ryan, it's been an absolute pleasure as always.
And you, man.
Thanks for the emergency edition of this podcast.
Yeah, we'll be back.
Everyone listening, thanks for tuning in and for staying with us. Please follow us on social media, on all channels. We're at RabonaMag, the same handle everywhere. And yeah, we'll catch you soon. Maybe, was it next Monday?
Next Monday.
Catch you soon.
See you later.
When I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. And while combing my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now, I say a little prayer for you. take time. And all through my coffee break time, I say a little pray for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.